Welcome to SCOTUSCast. On February 26, 2008, the Supreme Court heard oral argument on a case involving the issue of presentment under the False Claims Act, Allison Engine Co. v. the United States. The case poses the following question. Whether a plaintiff asserting a cause of action under Section 3729A2 or Section 3729A3 of the False Claims Act is required to prove that a false claim was submitted to the federal government, or whether it is sufficient to establish that the claim was paid using federal funds. Mayor Brown's Marsha Madsen discusses the case. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Attorney Madsen.
Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard argument in Allison Engine v. United States, Xrel Sanders. This case involves the Civil False Claims Act. It's a statute under which contractors can be subject to substantial penalties such as treble damages. The legal question at issue in the appeal is whether the False Claims Act only applies to contractors who contract directly with the federal government and companies that as subcontractors have their claims passed through to the federal government, or whether under the Act, businesses that don't deal directly with the government, but instead deal with other companies that contract with the government or that receive government grant money, also can be subjected to the litigation risk and substantial penalties imposed under the False Claims Act. Why should citizens and businesses be concerned about an overbroad interpretation of this statute? The False Claims Act is a civil rather than a criminal statute that was originally enacted in 1863 to address false and abusive claims by Civil War contractors. The statute has six hallmarks, and I'm just going to describe these briefly. It doesn't require actual intent to commit fraud. It has a low standard of proof. It has quitam provisions that allow a private citizen known as a relator to sue in the name of the government and recover a bounty up to 30% of the government's recovery. It includes a treble damages provision. It includes substantial additional penalties between $5,000 and $11,000 for each false claim, and it pays the relator's legal fees. These cases, whether they're filed directly by the Department of Justice or a relator, involve not only a dispute about the regulations or the contract, but also a lengthy investigation. And a defendant may well find itself dealing with a federal investigation that may involve a parallel criminal investigation as well, and the threat of debarment. In a quitam, the government frequently ultimately decides not to intervene, but it usually investigates the charges and then allows the relator to press the case without the DOJ. An FCA action disrupts the ability of the contracting parties to resolve disputes through traditional means, including arbitration and negotiation. FCA claims do this by imposing between the contracting parties the federal investigative and prosecutorial machinery, and a relator who has little or no incentive to resolve immaterial violations. The Allison Engine case is significant because it involves the relationship that the business being sued under the False Claims Act must have to the government, whether it is a direct relationship with the contractor or grantee, or whether the claims are passed through, and thus involves an attenuated relationship of a subcontractor far down the line from the government. Inappropriate false claims actions are a growing problem for companies receiving federal funds, whether as government contracts or through grants. Because of the unique structure of the FCA, the low intent requirement, and the burden of proof and penalties, it imposes substantial risks on companies. If the court in Allison Engine finds that presentment of a claim to a government official is not required in all circumstances, the Allison Engine case could dramatically expand the potential liability of companies operating around the periphery of the government contracts and grants area. And just to give you some sense of the potential magnitude of this, the government spends almost $500 billion a year in procurement funds and about $2.8 trillion overall each year. In Allison Engine, the Sixth Circuit ruled that direct presentment of claims to the federal government was not required under two of three provisions of the False Claims Act. The court thus ruled that subcontractors who did not have their claims passed through the prime and presented to the government could still be held liable under the Act. The Sixth Circuit's decision is in conflict with a well-regarded D.C. Circuit decision in United States, Xrel Totten v. Bombardier, that was written by then-judge, now Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. Although it arose in the subcontractor context, the reasoning of the Sixth Circuit's Allison Engine opinion, if upheld by the Supreme Court, could apply equally to parties that contract with federal grantees. The dispute centers on the liability-imposing provision of the False Claims Act 31 U.S.C. 3729. Section A1 explicitly requires, quote, knowingly presenting, close quote, or causing to be presented, a, quote, false claim or fraudulent claim for payment or approval, close quote. Section A2 creates liability for a false claim for statements made or used to, quote, get a false or fraudulent claim paid or approved by the government, close quote. And Section A3 creates liability for conspiracy, that is, creates liability if one, quote, conspires to defraud the government by getting a false or fraudulent claim allowed or paid, close quote. During the oral argument, several justices appeared skeptical of the expansiveness of the government's and the relator's position. Section A1 uses the words present and presented in relation to the government employee, and people generally talk about this as a presentment requirement. In contrast, Sections A2 and A3 of the statute do not use the words present or presented or presentment. The relators and the government, in its amicus brief, rely on the absence of specific words requiring presentment of the claim in A2 and A3 and contend that the statute should be read to include any attempts to get money from grantees or prime contractors that obtain money from the government. But one of the principal flaws of this argument was demonstrated by Chief Justice Roberts in his questioning of the relator's counsel. And I quote this portion of his question. So, your argument, your understanding of the scope of the statute is exactly the same if the words by the government were replaced by with federal funds. You think the statute is exactly the same as if it said with federal funds instead of by the government. Close quote. The relator's and the government's argument definitely ignores this limitation. And several of the justices seemed uncomfortable with the expansion of potential liability under the False Claims Act that would result from such a ruling. Chief Justice Roberts pointed out, by asking a hypothetical to government counsel, that liability under the loose interpretation being argued would allow for False Claims Act liability on a chemical company far attenuated from any government contract. The facts he posed were as follows. A chemical company that fraudulently inflated its costs when the chemicals were sold to a paint company, which sold the paint to a painter who worked as a subcontractor of a prime contractor working for a state when the state received or used money from a federal grant. That's the end of the example. Given the expansiveness of the government's and the relator's position, several of the justices sought a limiting principle, and there were questions about the possibility of a limiting principle from Justices Ginsburg and Scalia. Allison Engine's position was two-pronged. First, Allison Engine's attorney, Ted Olson, asked the court to reaffirm its 20-year-old decision concerning the same interpretive question, the Tanner decision, in which the court limited liability to businesses contracting or passing claims through to the government and rejected the government funds argument. Second, Olson focused on the fact that each subsection of the statute explicitly refers to the government. Both Section A2 and A3 explicitly restrict FCA liability to situations in which the government, as opposed to a grantee or prime contractor, is being defrauded. Allison Engine's counsel focused on these and other statements from the statute, all directly related solely to the government as distinguished from people with whom the government contracts or to whom it provides grants. Justice Breyer was unsatisfied with Olson's focus on the statute's description of the government and asked a series of questions about the section of the False Claims Act that defines the term claim, which is in Section C of the statute. Olson explained that the broad definition of claim does not define every type of claim as actionable under the statute. That is left to Section A and its subsections, which limit the fraudulent claims that are the subjects of the Act. Toward the end of the argument, the case developed a big wrinkle. The justices were thrown a curve by relator's counsel. The case was taken up by the court on the assumption that no bill was presented directly from Allison Engine to the government. but Relator's counsel dropped a bombshell when he told the court that the next best thing had happened. A certificate of conformance had gone directly from the subcontractor Allison Engine to the Navy. However, the evidence he pointed to for this assertion was not in his brief, but in the appendix to the appeals court ruling. Well, then there's less to this case than we originally had thought, Scalia exclaimed, suggesting that Allison Engine could, in fact, be covered by the statute. Chief Justice Roberts picked up on the revelation. He said, quote, if in fact, as you suggest, Allison Engine submitted the certificate to the Navy person, then the question presented in this case is not, in fact, presented here, close quote. If the court determined that a certificate of conformance had been provided to the Navy to get the prime contractor paid, the reason the court decided to review the case would no longer be correct, and the court would likely dismiss the case as improvidently granted. In rebuttal, Allison Engine's lawyer, Olson, scrambled to save the case. He discussed several pages from the trial court's opinion and said that despite what Relator's counsel had said, there was no evidence that the certificates had been presented to the Navy. Olson calmly shrugged off the Relator's argument as backing and felling. Whether or not the case is in jeopardy is uncertain. If the court determines that the evidence as reviewed by the trial court indicates that the certificates were not received by the Navy, there is still a chance that the court could find a subcontractor's preparation of certificates of conformity with the understanding that they were necessary for the prime contractor to be paid was sufficient under Section A2 of the statute. But that seems unlikely. The better reading of the statute, as argued by Allison Engine's counsel, requires materials to be actually presented to the government. So in sum, the submission of an arguably false claim to a private entity that either receives funds from the federal government as a prime contractor or as a grantee is not equivalent to the submission of a claim to the government itself.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.